In early 1968, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. came to K-State to give a talk just months before his assassination. The trip brought Dr. King through Kansas City's airport. At the time, Bob Hughes Jr. was a college student at KU, and his dad was a local leader of the NAACP. So when Bob got a call from his dad urging him to come meet the civil rights icon, this was his response.
Come on, Daddy, you know, I got things to do. You guys go ahead and deal with this, you know. And so he was a little more forceful, and you really need to meet this gentleman and so forth. At the end of the day, I was quite pleased that I had that, I won't say made that decision, because he voluntold me to do this, right?
That's how Bob Hughes Jr. ended up in a picture of about a dozen or so local citizens, mostly leaders in the Black community, hanging out with Martin Luther King in a TWA lounge. Bob's in the corner of the room, but the middle of the photo. He looks serious and dignified, wearing glasses with his gray suit and black tie.
Yeah, my kids all have this picture. It's been on Facebook. It's been floating around for the last almost 50 years. But even as I left there, you know, I felt like I knew the guy a lot more than what, you know, I had just seen on television. I felt I was blessed to have that opportunity to really meet and speak with him, shake his hand.
Sometimes history happens to you like it happened to Bob. But if you look back at that photo, you'll see another guy, Chester Owens Jr. He's kneeling out in front, looking straight into the camera. He was there very much on purpose. I'm Gina Kaufman here on KCUR Central Standard with Chester Owens Jr. to talk about that meeting and what it means to him now, 50 years after King's assassination. Chester Owens Jr., good morning.
Good morning.
What brought you to the airport that day in 1968?
Well, the people in the picture is a group from called Progress Incorporated. That time, Senator George Haley, who had been elected in 1964, was a classmate of Dr. King at Morehouse University, and they were friends. Dr. King called George, Senator Haley, and asked if he could arrange transportation for him to Manhattan, Kansas, where he was speaking at K-State. At that time, I happened to be president of Progress Incorporated, which is a nonpartisan political group that came out of George's election in 1964. George asked if I would call and get some members of the organization to meet Dr. King at the airport. I might like to add that Bob Hughes Jr., who you've had on the radio, I'm named after his grandfather. We are first cousins. Well, his father and I are first cousins. We're second cousins. So we're very close. So I kid Bob about this all the time. So that's why we were there. We were there to meet him. And also, George had to run in November of 68 for re-election. So we would ask Dr. King if he could come back and speak in Kansas, which he agreed. I have the news article. He agreed to come back either in October or early November of 1968. But the primary reason was we would provide transportation for him to K-State.
So he was supposed to come, but of course...
He passed.
Yeah.
He was assassinated in April.
You know, in the 1950s and 1960s, I understand that you were deeply involved in the civil rights movement. Can you talk just a little bit about what you were doing and why you were doing it?
Very much so. When I returned to Kansas City in December of 1958, after I finished college and after serving 4 years in the military, there were a lot of things going on around the country. Dr. King had been in Kansas City in 1957 and spoke at Sumner High School, so I have the program there. So I could not wait to get involved in a civil rights activity in Kansas City, Kansas. And when I came back, there was very little activity in Kansas City, Kansas, except for a group called the Northwest District Citizens Association, who was doing a lot of things, which this organization later turned to CORE. NAACP was there, but were not dealing with many issues. Now, there had been some issues in Kansas City, Missouri, but in Kansas City, Kansas, very little was going on. So I got involved with the Northwest District Citizens Association and the NAACP. There was an incident that occurred where the NAACP had sent out a request that all chapters picket in front of Woolworth in conjunction with what had happened in Greensboro, North Carolina. Well, an article appeared in the paper that the Kansas City, Kansas chapter of the NAACP would not participate. It was by the president. The mayor stated that there would be no demonstrations in Kansas City, Kansas, and he had a letter to that effect in his desk drawer. This outraged some of the people in Kansas City, Kansas, including Bob Hughes and a number of his friends, Bob Hughes Sr. and a number of his friends, and so that generated activity. So that's really how it began. So I became involved with that group, too.
When you say you became involved, how?
Well, I wound up, with Northwest District Citizens Association and CORE because the stores downtown Kansas City, Kansas would not hire African-American clerks. Kansas City, Kansas was just as segregated as Birmingham, Alabama, no public accommodations laws. And so I wound up as chair of the Labor and Industry Committee. And we sent letters to all the stores. We were asking for employment just as clerked in the stores downtown, as they had done in Kansas City, Missouri, about 5 years prior. I have copies of the letters. Only one store responded to the letter. We wanted to meet with them. Only one store responded, and that was J.C. Penney's. Well, two, J.C. Penney's and W.T. Grant. So we met with all of the stores. We tried to meet with them as a group, and we knew there was an organization. They told us there was no group. So we had to meet individually with those groups, which was quite a chore.
Yeah,
that's a lot of activity. And the interesting thing is that many people were not aware of we had to do that. And if you can imagine the time that they were set. Was usually in the early afternoon. Many people were working. I had a job where I could leave at any time. There were people who took off from work. But the committee was a forceful committee. All of them were members of Northwest District Citizens Association. So we met with them, and only two stores voluntarily hired African Americans. So we wound up having to schedule pickets. And if you can imagine scheduling pickets from Minnesota Avenue from 6th Street to 11th Street, and there was a lot of stores, that was quite a chore. And a lady by the name of Alila Shanks and my wife and myself basically scheduled all of the pickets.
You know, I mean, you've just told some stories that just on their own lay out a lot of credentials for you to talk about, you know, civil rights in Kansas City and this visit from Martin Luther King Jr. And yet you have asked us to introduce you as just an ordinary citizen. Why is that?
Well, I guess I relate to Dr. King in that you do things because they are right things to do. I might add that I'm not putting myself out as, quote, a leader.
Right. No, certain, clearly you are not.
In Kansas City, Kansas, there were two people, Carl Randolph Sr. and Leela Shanks. Those are the people who, in Kansas City, Kansas, led the modern-day civil rights in Kansas City, Kansas. Those two persons were the leaders and also were both members of this committee. But I just feel it's the right thing to do. You just do it. You're just a citizen. There's no special pronouncement that she made about you or anything. You're just an ordinary citizen doing the right thing.
Well, I want to get back to this visit because I am curious about, you know, when in this climate where you're talking about there are pickets, there are meetings trying to persuade local businesses in downtown Kansas City, Kansas to hire African Americans, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. comes to Kansas. Was that a big deal? Were people talking about it a lot? Was he in demand to make appearances at like churches, schools?
Well, Dr. King, this was January. Matter of fact, it was January 18th, 1968. The civil rights activity that I was referring to occurred in probably 1961, 62, so that had been all over. But when he was coming to Kansas City, there was no public pronouncement because he was just stopping off here. I might add that he probably would have been considered by, quote, the establishment, whatever that means, as a troublemaker if he had come to Kansas City during that time, the same as he was considered in cities in the South.
Yeah, talk to us about the Martin Luther King Jr. of 1968, early 1968. He was a much more controversial and embattled figure than we tend to necessarily remember him for being.
Yes, the discussion that we had after he came and Senator Hale introduced all of us to him, he was there with one of his aides. We went into a lounge and we talked primarily about the war in Vietnam. That was a subject that a couple of us tried to steer him to talk about. And as you know, 1968, it was very controversial. Contrary to what many people believe, all of the civil rights organizations and all of the major black religious denominations, all the labor unions who had provided both financial and moral support backed away from him after the speech in 1967 at Riverside Church in New York. In the greater Kansas City area, there was a national organization set up called the Clergy and Laity Concerned About the War in Vietnam. There was a chapter here, and the meetings were held at UMKC, and there was a professor over there by the name of Norman Royal, and he was kind of the coordinator. So we met. There were only five African Americans who attended the meetings, my wife and myself, another very good friends, the Macfields, and another gentleman by the name of Andre Swansea.
What was the mission of the organization? What were the goals?
To talk about the war in Vietnam. It was not just, it was not fair. This is before it became popular. There were very, very few people involved, It wasn't as portrayed. Now, the early people who, early on, we were ostracized. There were things that did occur to us.
Like what?
I won't go into in detail. All of a sudden, the FBI showed up. When you talked about the war in Vietnam, people would call you communist. You were not patriotic. A lot of things occurred.
When you talk about not wanting to go into detail, why is that? Is it painful or?
No, it's not painful. It was just some things that occurred with some agencies that still you're reluctant to talk about publicly because they haven't changed, not really.
Wow. Well, you know, I want to talk to you about, you know, so 1968. Dr. King arrives in Kansas City, controversial for, among other things, his position on the Vietnam War. What were you looking forward to, I mean, with meeting him, with getting to talk to him?
Well, knowing that some of us had been ostracized here in Kansas City, ridiculed, we understood very plainly what he was going through. And so that is some support that at least he would know that there were some people who felt as he did. Not a whole lot of people, even the majority of people in that picture, did not feel that civil rights and the war should be connected. I read in the paper day before yesterday where someone occurred that when Dr. King died, he was kind of a broken man. And that's a part that a lot of people, even today, particular religious leaders, is that they do not like to remember that they backed away from him. I always suggest to people that they read Taylor Branch's book, Parting the Waters. There's a chapter in there called Moses in Macomb, Macomb, Mississippi, and King in Kansas City. That was at the National Baptist Convention, USA Incorporated, which was held here in Kansas City. Read that chapter, and you'd better understand what I'm talking about, how people backed away from him. So after I went home that night, my children had three daughters. My youngest was only five. And I made the statement to my wife that you could see fear. And also you could see, I made the comment that you could see death in his eyes.
Oh, you saw that?
Yes, that's what I saw.
Can you explain that? I mean, that seems like maybe on some level intuitive, but can you explain what you were seeing?
Well, you have to, in my opinion, in order to really understand the civil rights, the modern day civil rights movement, that's what I called it. Civil rights started in 1619 in this country. But the modern day civil rights movement, you have to put it in a proper time perspective. If you look at it through 2018 eyes as to what's actually going on there, you really can't get a good picture. It's really hard to really explain what actually occurred.
You know, I'm talking to Chester Owens Jr., who is in a photo with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. that was taken in January of 1968 here in Kansas City, just months before King's assassination 50 years ago today. And Chester, you know, I want to know what else you guys talked about at that meeting. You know, you made this observation that King, you could see fear in him, that you could see death in his eyes. But you've also said that when you look at this picture of local community leaders all meeting with him, that not everyone in this photo agreed with his position on Vietnam. Did you guys talk about that?
Not so much in that meeting. We were just really there to kind of make him feel comfortable. We did not discuss this in the meeting. Some of the other people in the picture that we had talked to, about the war in Vietnam, encouraged them to get involved, which they did not. No one in that picture got involved in the early part of it, later when it became popular. I might add that yesterday I Googled Dr. King at K-State. And there's a world of information on there. And one of the persons who went back 50 years after Dr. King spoke at K-State, his name was Bill Worley. There were five people who went back and reflected on what that was like that day. And Bill Worley said that you could see him and he was tired. And he said, I guess he had because he'd been involved all of his life. Of course, Dr. King was only 39 years old, but you could see he was just tired. So he saw the same thing.
When you look back on that moment, I mean, you've said that it's hard to understand what was going on in the civil rights movement if you look at it through today's eyes. What is it about your day-to-day lived experience in the 1960s that helps you understand that moment?
The moment in 1968?
Yeah.
What if you were actively involved? You have a different perspective. The fear that many people that were involved, the fear that we had. But I might add that the people who were actively involved with hands-on. If you talk to people my age in Kansas City, Kansas now, they were all involved. But fortunately, like we scheduled all the pickets, so we knew who was involved. And but you just have to, it's really, really hard to explain.
When you say you were the fear, what was it exactly that you were afraid of?
Well, you were in Kansas, for example, you were going against the norm. You did not know what to expect. When you walked out on the streets of Minnesota Avenue on that Saturday morning, we did not know what to expect. Some of us who were in the Northwest District Citizens Association, who later became CORE, Congress of Racial Equality had taken a vow to nonviolence. But you did not know what was going to be the reaction.
And you're talking about the day of the picket.
Yes, day that the picket started. Were you going to be harassed by the police as to what was going on in the South? You had heard about what happened in Chicago, which Dr. King said it was more frightening in Chicago than it was in Mississippi. You didn't know what to expect. The fear that what if something would happen to you? But I might add that going through that, fear was eliminated from most of our lives. I fear nothing.
My spirit, because of what you've been through already?
Well, at that time, when you say, well, if I go out here today, will something happen to me? And when nothing happens, and when you continue to do what's right, with, at least for myself and the people who were involved, your spiritual beliefs, and I might quote a scripture that says, for God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of sound mind. Things like that becomes clear. You understand, you begin to understand a whole lot of things. And I might add that some of us felt that, at least for myself, I was actually converted to my spiritual belief. Even though I'd been active in church, I still had a lot of fear. But that really changed my beliefs, my spiritual beliefs, so to speak. And I could clearly see some things that were, what I believe, put into action. And even what the older scribes and people did back in times, what they possibly went through.
You know, you say that you didn't know what to expect that day when you went out onto 7th and Minnesota. What did happen in that picket?
People looked at us strange. Well, let me go back prior to that. In probably 1960 or 61, there were a group of four young women and a young man set in Kansas City, Kansas, at D'Angelo's restaurant. And my sister happened to be one of them. And so we'd had experience with picketing there, because here again, I had not been back in Kansas City no longer than a couple of years. And again, I was kind of young compared to some of the other people, and Bob Hughes Sr. was very much involved in that. And we started picketing D'Angelo's, and I guess because I was a few years younger, I was what they call the office manager. So here again, I was scheduling the pickets. And so I'd had experience with that, which later helped when we did at Picket Minnesota Avenue. But we probably received a lot of reaction. Some of the people were names we were called if we were picketing. That did not occur on Minnesota Avenue. But we did not know what to expect from the police. Well, we knew that if you start cutting off funds, encouraging people not to shop at stores, we didn't know what was going to happen.
Well, when Dr. King came to Kansas City and you got to meet him, do you remember how, I mean, I've heard you say that you came away with a sense of his fatigue and his fear and his isolation. Have you talked to other people who were there about what they saw and how they've carried that with them, possibly even in the work they've done locally in civil rights, politics, journalism, what have you?
Well, in the picture, Bob Hughes Sr., who was an icon, and the things that that man did in Kansas City, Kansas, and Kansas, Missouri, particularly in the field of housing, not just in Kansas City, Kansas, and Kansas, Missouri, but across the country, is something that many people don't talk about. But many, I don't know about, but many of the other persons in the picture, even though they were well in their respective fields and they were active in Senator Haley's campaign, were not that much involved in civil rights. Guy O. Taylor, who's in the picture, Mr. Taylor was the Kansas manager of the Kansas City Call office. Now, he did a fantastic job in that he made sure that everything was covered, you know, wrote articles about what was going on. But the other people were good people, but they were not involved.
What What do you think, you know, what do you want people to know about Dr. King's role or legacy that doesn't always get mentioned when we remember him?
Well, I don't think that people really, even to this day, really know what he really believed. About the only thing that you hear is the I Have a Dream speech. And even that speech, when I used to be invited to speak, and occasionally I get invited to speak now, I would read the original speech, read the first part of it, and nobody would recognize what he was, who it was. That the really the speech that he had when he spoke at the March on Washington, the beginning of it.
What's in the beginning that people don't usually hear when they hear the clip, the more, you know?
He said, we're here to redeem, we've received a blank check, and we've come to cash that check. And he goes into that, some history there. And he had a time limit, as all the speakers had. And he was really almost through with his speech. But Mahalia Jackson, who was there, said, tell them about your dream, Dr. King. And basically, I Have a Dream speech had been done in Detroit, Michigan, in June of 63, 2 years. And she said, tell them about your dream. That's when he launched in the I Have a Dream speech. That speech had already been done, at least a portion of it.
What does the blank check piece of it mean to you?
We still have a blank check. Is that people of color, particularly African Americans, still do not have equal rights. We're still not free. To me, it's going the other way. It's going back the other way. And so we're still trying to cash that.
And you're saying in 2018?
In 2018, yes.
You know, I'd love to hear more about that. I mean, just your sense that things are going back the other way.
Well, the first thing, I'm in my 80s. I never dreamed. I prayed and felt that at this stage in my life, my grandchildren would not have to deal with things that we had to deal with. It's hard to explain to people, and I have, you know, family, I have grandchildren, but I'd see young people, irregardless of color, but I see young men of color frightened, and as a grandfather, when you wonder, will my grandkids leave home, or when other kids leave home, particularly black males, what will happen to them? It's hard to see when your mothers and your fathers see their sons walk out of the door, will they come back alive? That's a horrible, horrible feeling. And we see nothing happening, and it's getting worse, and more of it is occurring. And you wonder, where will it end? And I guess the thing that disturbs me, the same thing that disturbed, I guess, many people doing Dr. King, and this is a part of the comments that I made when we had the rally after Dr. King died. But the silence in this country is so loud until it's deafening. The silence, the complicity. See, far as I'm concerned, America killed Dr. King. Because the silence then, and we should know better now, but we are as silent now as we were in 1968. Matter of fact, we're more silent. I look at the city in which I live. We're silent with the things that's occurring to African Americans in the city where I live now. It's far worse than it was in 1968.
You know, in 1968, you were a part of the rally in the aftermath of King's assassination. Can you talk about that moment in Kansas City? I want to get back to what you were just saying, but I'd love to hear your memories of that moment.
Well, it's interesting. They've had on TV what happened in Kansas City. There were riots and burning. Nothing happened in Kansas City, Kansas. There was nothing that occurred. Another part of the history that people really don't know. The first thing was that there was a black police chief had been appointed by the mayor. Mayor George McDowell had appointed Boston Daniels the chief of police. And so he not only was the chief of police, he was a very active part of the community. People knew him. The community was a very, very close-knit community. After the riot, after the assassination, the superintendent of the school decided not to let the children out of school, which was stupid. Some things occurred there. Chief Daniels, along with a minister by the name of Seth Beverly, to me, far as I'm concerned, quelled the disturbance. I might add that I just say whatever happens, happen, and probably needs to happen. And, you know, I still feel like that.
I guess I feel a little confused not knowing what happened.
Well, nothing happened over here. But I guess when you assassinate a person who's speaking love, you're angry enough to do whatever. People can call it violence. I don't call it that. But they call out, they put a curfew in both Kansas City, Kansas, and Kansas City, Missouri. And this is the part of history that I guess you don't hear people talk about. It was interesting as to how Kansas City, Kansas was easy to isolate the black community in Kansas City, Kansas. And there were not a lot of businesses in Kansas City, Kansas, like it was in Kansas City, Missouri, except for Minnesota Avenue. There were some young people who wanted to do something and probably would have done something. But there were two gentlemen there, one by the name of John Burris and my brother Uriel Owens. And they said, you know, it's interesting. There is nothing on Minnesota Avenue. It's not protected. Well, there are some things going on in Kansas City, Kansas. And those two people were able to convince probably the leaders of those young people not to do anything over there. And far as I'm concerned, those two people, along with Chief Boston Daniels and Reverend Stetson Beverly, is what kept Kansas City, Kansas from exploding.
You know, today you've mentioned that the silence that you believe killed Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968, that it's louder today than it was then.
Yes.
What would you like to see happening today?
I like to see people do what's right. I would like to see particularly the religious community step up and say, this is wrong. I would like to see particularly the religious community, both black and white, to step up, not be silent. Dr. King was more than just a civil rights leader. He affected the whole world. He was a citizen and stated this, I'm a citizen of the world. I would like to see people say that war is wrong. Killing is wrong. Live out what you really believe, particularly if you're from the religious community.
This might be very specific, but how would you like to hear people saying that? Where would you like to hear them saying it? I mean, I feel like individuals are trying to say things like shouting them into the Twitter sphere or whatever, but I'm not sure. What form would you like to hear that message taking?
Well, let's just take one of the police shootings. Let's take the one in South Carolina, where the fellow was taking the video, and they didn't realize he was taking the video, but he was running away, and he was shot in the back and killed. It's interesting, the first person on the scene was an African-American who said that we gave him CPR because they didn't know at the time it was being videoed. Nothing really happened to that person. Whatever, like, not from the black community, but from the white community, said that's wrong, that type of thing needs to stop. And we're going to stand fast, particularly the religious community. And I hate to say this, but the white church in particular say this is wrong. And once that begins to happen, this stops.
Chester Owens, Jr., thank you so much. There's an opportunity to talk more about Dr. King and his legacy here in Kansas City tonight. Join KCUR and the UMKC Miller Nichols Library for a conversation at 6:30 at Pearson Hall on the UMKC campus. You can get details at kcur.org/MLK. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. Welcome to KCUR's Central Standard. We're looking now into a controversy in the world of psychology about something called evolutionary psychology. That is, the idea that selective pressures in the age-old fight for genetic survival have shaped our anxieties, our decision-making processes, our personalities, and our neuroses. That it's not just what happened to us in our lifetimes, but way before that. For the rest of today's show, we're going to find out why this idea is controversial and then how a KU professor's research might start to offer a compromise. So, Armin Schultz, with us from KU, start us off by explaining just briefly this conflict over the idea of evolutionary psychology. What are the two sides, as it were, quick and dirty?
So, quick and dirty. On the one hand, there are evolutionary psychologists who think that really we can only do psychology well if we place it in an evolutionary biological framework. If we understand the as you say, the selective pressures that have shaped human minds over the years, and only if we do that will psychology be properly scientific and be will be done properly. On the other side, are critics who I think have a number of different concerns, but two major set of concerns. On the one hand, they say, look, doing evolutionary biology generally, doing that well is quite tricky. You need to figure out the selective pressures on any trait, whether it's the liver, whether it's the flower shapes of a particular plant, or whether it's a psychological trait. You'd need to know something about the ancestral version of that trait, where that trait comes from. You need to know something about the genetics of that trait. You want to know things about the population, how big the population was, whether it was divided into groups, how much migration there was. All of these different complex issues need to be settled. Now, when it comes to psychological traits, however, it seems like addressing these questions is quite difficult. Psychological traits like tastes for fatty foods don't fossilize, neither do brain structures. Or for that matter, we don't even quite know how the taste for fatty foods translates into brain structure.
I'm going to jump in and pick up on this taste for fatty foods because that's the example that came to my mind. People talk about that a lot, like this idea that we crave more fats and sugars than is really healthy and eat too much of that stuff. There are people who attribute that to like that in caveman times, you know, maybe we needed an extreme desire and taste for fatty foods in order to go out and kill an animal, you know, to sustain ourselves, to survive. And that no longer serves us in today's world. Is that kind of a model for how other traits are explained? Traits that really maybe don't make sense today? Anxieties?
Absolutely. I think it's one model. I don't think evolutionary psychologists have to explain every current malaise in some way, just like the taste for fatty foods. But certainly that's one model in which evolutionary psychologists have been approaching the psychology. Absolutely.
And the problem with it, basically, according to critics, is that it's hard to really know, basically.
That's exactly right. It's hard to know. I mean, was it really? Is it true that humans faced a food shortage in such a way back in the day that having a taste for fatty foods made you more likely to survive or a more attractive mate? Maybe having a taste for fatty foods signaled something about status, and the selective pressures were completely different. Maybe a taste for fatty foods actually was maladaptive back in the day, and it just stuck around because it was happened to be linked to other things that were adaptive. For example, being a high status individual in society, so you could afford to eat high fat foods that they're not very good for you.
Well, we're going to get back to Armin Schultz on his current research and how it might reconcile these two camps later on. But I want to learn more about evolutionary psychology first and what it exactly proposes with someone who works in the field. Yashin Jessica Lee, good morning.
Good morning.
How did you get interested in evolutionary psychology?
Well, kind of in a roundabout way. I was a biology and society major in college. And when I was in college, I took a course called Animal Behavior. In this class, we learned mostly about non-human animal behavior and why those animals engage in the behaviors that they do. but there was also a section on human behavior. And in particular, I remember a class in which we learned about morning sickness. And the professor who studied this said that there might be an adaptive reason that pregnant women get sick. It was a way to get rid of pathogens and to keep the fetus healthy during a time when we didn't have electricity or medical care or doctors around the corner. And I just found that quite fascinating, that these, what we might otherwise believe are maladaptive behaviors, may actually have a functional basis. And that's what led me to explore the field of evolutionary psychology.
But something like morning sickness doesn't seem like a psychological trait or a psychological experience. It seems like just biology.
Correct. And evolution has been used to explain behaviors in the non-human animal realm quite a bit, but evolutionary psychology is relatively new. Now, Darwin actually proposed that evolution would be integral to understanding human psychology. However, the field didn't really take off until a few decades ago.
The idea of, like, evolution explaining psychology, which I think that a lot of humans, like, we like to think of anything closely tied to our personalities as very individual. You know what I mean? And there is something a little strange about thinking that something that happened to someone centuries before you were born is making you nervous right now.
Right. Well, that is one of the controversies of evolutionary psychology, not from a scientific standpoint, but some people tend to have this reaction where they don't want to believe that their genes control behavior or cognitions. And that sometimes that's very difficult for people to really wrap their minds around. But to me, the utility of evolutionary psychology is thinking about human universals and the problems that our ancestors may have faced. It creates this opportunity to produce novel hypotheses that you wouldn't get from any other theory or area of research.
Can you give an example? I mean, you've mentioned morning sickness, which I have heard is just this huge mystery, why this would happen when it not only seems to serve no purpose, but actually really interferes with day-to-day life for a huge number of people. Is there another example?
Sure. Something more within the psychological realm.
Yeah.
Maybe an observation that across cultures, men tend to engage in more aggressive behaviors. And if you look at these violent behaviors like murder rates, they tend to be committed more by males than females. Now, one explanation for that is that it's purely cultural. So society brought us up to in this such a way that men felt that they had to be violent in order to get respected, whereas women were not raised to believe that. However, an evolutionary perspective would ask, well, is there maybe an adaptive function, not necessarily for murder, but for men to be somewhat more risk-taking than women? And if so, why might that be?
And I can understand now why this is so controversial, this field.
Yes. So some of the gender differences can be a little controversial, but it's mostly a descriptive field. So evolutionary psychology observes what's already happening in society. And in order to say that we shouldn't study it at all, we would have to either pretend it doesn't exist or just not really explore potential underlying reasons why. And if we can't explore why, then we don't have all the tools that we need to intervene.
So you are an assistant professor of marketing, and
yes.
I understand that it's actually quite common for people who study evolutionary psychology to end up in a business environment.
It's not extremely common, but there are some of us that have been trained from evolutionary perspectives. However, most people that study evolutionary psychology also explore proximate mechanisms, which means that an evolutionary perspective often looks at ultimate mechanisms, which means it explores why, the why behavior. Why do you have this? Could it be adaptive? More proximate explanations that would look into features of our immediate environment, for example, to explain behavior. They're not incompatible. For example, you could have an ultimate explanation for why a baby cries in order to get their mother to take care of them or their father to pay attention to them, to get the care that they would need in order to survive, because babies are relatively helpless. That would be the why of these cries. A more proximate explanation for why babies cry would be the situation, such as the baby is feeling uncomfortable or may not have enough food available. So they're not competing hypotheses. They are just at different levels of analysis.
Or like answering different, like meaning different things by why, like the immediate why and then the bigger why, kind of?
Yeah, sort of like that. And evolutionary psychologists would say that humans have a set of sort of universal problems that we have to solve right now and in our evolutionary past. And these problems largely surround survival and reproduction, what we know to be the tenets of evolution. And how they solve these problems are the features that we see today in humans. And so we try to work backwards.
Armin Schultz, jump in here. What do you think, first of all, of what you've just heard?
Yeah, so I think it's a great example of where some of the controversy has been located. So let's just stick with the example of risk taking and gender differences in risk taking.
Yes, that sounds very controversial.
That sounds controversial, and because it has potentially huge implications for lots of professional environments and in various ways. Now, there are two ways you can go. On the one hand, one critics are concerned are saying, do we really know that there's been Do we have a very good story that there's been selective pressure differentially for the genders for risk-taking? Or is this just sort of a bias that we have right now in society and we're looking for a way to underline that bias to sort of give it sort of a scientific credibility that it might not otherwise have? So critics are worried about that. And now what Yixin sort of said partly in response is to say, hey, we're just using evolutionary theory here to generate hypotheses. This is a tool to get us to think of new hypotheses to test. Maybe it turns out that, if there's this gender difference in risk-taking, we should expect to find financial traders that are male to be more engaged in more risky trades than traders that are more female, things like that. And these hypotheses we wouldn't have thought of otherwise, maybe things like that. If that's right, I think that's fine. Then critics are going to say, oh, that's a very weak use of evolutionary theory here. That's not a new science of the mind. You could also do whatever cold bath psychology, where you say, hey, whenever I take a cold bath, that gets me to think of new hypotheses to test. And so I'm gonna make it a new field. That's great, but that's not very substantial in that way.
And so
I think that's where the conflict has been.
And
has been
your
spinning.
Your recent research has been, credited for possibly trying to bridge this gap. Do you think it's an important gap to bridge?
I think it is an important gap to bridge, as it happens. I think it is an important gap because both sides have a lot that's right here. On the one hand, I do think doing evolutionary biology well is difficult, going to a talk in an evolutionary biology department sort of convinces one of that. It's actually very hard to do that well. On the other hand, I agree with Yixin and many other evolutionary psychologists to say this really has tremendous importance for understanding how human minds work.
So how are you bridging that gap?
Yeah, by pulling the rabbit out of the hat. Here's how you do that. So I think that the two main points that I want to emphasize is that often critics overemphasize the difficulties of knowing something about the evolutionary history of psychological traits. And there's various ways to spell this out, but an easy way to do this is to say this. Often it's hard to – it's true that psychological traits, for example, don't fossilize, but the products of psychological traits do fossilize. So it is true that the taste for fatty foods – to go back to that example we're not going to find fossil evidence for that. But if you have a taste for fatty foods, that's going to influence the sort of foods that you eat, and that's going to change the shape of your teeth, and maybe it's going to change the kind of tools you build in order to access that food.
And those are things you can study.
And those are things you can study, and you can make inferences based on those things about the sort of psychological features that humans had.
And there was one other point you wanted to make on our way up.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, and the other thing is there is a lot of uncertainty that's remaining in this way, so I don't think you're going to get a new science out of the mind of this, but you do get evidence, and that's something.
You get evidence, and that's something. You spoken like a true scientist. Thank you, Armin Schultz.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Yashin Jessica Lee.
Thanks.
Both of these experts joined us from KU. And you can listen back to this morning's conversations at your leisure at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. And if you missed our discussion about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s visit with local leaders in the community just months before his assassination, be sure and catch it there. You can also join KCUR and the Miller-Nichols Library for a live event this evening. If you want to hear more about King's legacy here in town, get more info on that at kcur.org/MLK. Tomorrow on KCUR's Central Standard, the new movie Love, Simon will get the screen time treatment, and so we want to know what it means to you that there's a mainstream romantic comedy for teens where the romance at the heart of the story is about two boys coming out in their high school and falling in love. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman.